couple of people mentioned that I never mentioned the year or the where it was. So they were like...
Okay, let's get started. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bloody Podcast. I am your host, Maria Felix, along with Lori Roggenkamp and our resident guest, Cash Abdimalik.
Hey!
Start off with Lori's corrections for the last episode.
Lori's corrections.
Which was Wanda Jean. What was her name?
Wanda Jean Allen.
Okay.
So, yes. So a lot of people, you know, I feel like got a lot of positive reviews about the episode, but a lot of Maria and I switch off. I would say Maria does the lion's share of the research, but I do some research.
She's busy. And she's a teacher.
Yes. we have very different styles in how we do the research. And a lot of people like to say that, you know, Maria is more storytelling and I'm more not giving a lot of facts. So I'm more just like, let's zip through this. We got places to be, which is not always not my intention, but I guess that's what people take away. So one of the things that was brought up was that in the last episode, which we got a lot of positive response from.
Yeah.
Mostly from Star who? Said, okay. My girlfriend said, oh, that was good that you did that.
It was really nice of you.
And, but most people were like, you didn't mention the year or where this was. And so I feel like now I can say the murder happened in 1989. She was executed by lethal injection in 2001, and it was in Oklahoma.
Ah.
Just FYI, in case you were wondering about, you know, the story, why I was light on the details, I apologize.
What was the county?
It was called Nunya County, and for Nunya business.
I think you did a great job. Thank you, Lori, for covering for me while we were gone. We went to Tulum. We won't talk about it a lot, but I did want to mention that La Tunda got me for our past listeners.
That's right.
I got some extreme food poisoning.
Oh no!
Hey, no me gusta. Ay, ayúdame.
No, ay. It did feel like Latunda was farting in my face all night, and I was vomiting all day. If anybody was curious to know, but I
did hold her hair and her hand and screamed at Latunda. I said, "Latunda, stop, Latunda."
Well, that's really cool. Thanks for sharing that. I'm sorry that you got that very sincerely.
I know, but you sound like a teacher.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for sharing that, Maria.
Now sit down.
That sounds just like my teachers.
No, please do your math homework.
You can shut up. We're covering a case that was requested by a fan.
Ah.
Yeah. Ooh. This is the case of Susan Cummings, the heiress and the polo player.
Ooh.
In 1997, Susan Cummings killed her polo athlete boyfriend.
Not polo wearer, maybe?
Also that.
Oh, okay.
Polo wearing boyfriend. Roberto Villegas.
No!
No, not Roberto!
So let's go back to the beginning. Susan Cummings was born on July 21st, 1962, to Irma and Samuel Cummings.
It was the summer of 62.
She was a fraternal twin with her twin sister, Diana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Lori, you're a twin.
I am. I'm a fraternal twin.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is an identical twin. So.
Oh, wow.
Identical twins are weird.
You know what? They are.
That's,
I'm just going to say it.
Yep.
They're very weird.
That's my fucking, my stand on that.
That's the hill.
It's the hill I'm going to die on.
That's really, that's the hill you'll die on?
It's a weird hill.
All right. I mean, I guess, you know, hey, you're not going to be alone for sure.
That's right.
I've told, when I tell some people that I'm a fraternal twin, they're always like, oh, okay. And then I say my aunt, my mom and my aunt are identical. They're like, oh, it's like, it's almost like I'm telling them they're conjoined or.
They get disappointed. It yeah. sucks.
They're like, oh, okay.
I'm not like disappointed. I just acknowledge it. I'm like, okay.
Like witchcraft, almost.
Yeah.
You're not going to say anything against it, but you don't want to mess with it.
Yeah.
Or them.
Yeah, for sure.
Their mother, Irma, came from a wealthy Swiss family, and Samuel was the owner of an arms dealing company called InterArms. Samuel had been a firearms expert during his time in the service, and afterwards he was recruited into the CIA as a weapons expert.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, he has a big life. He went through Europe buying up overstocked World War II weaponry that he then sold back to Hollywood for productions and to the Taiwanese government.
Fucking smarty over there.
Smarty.
Wow.
Yeah. And then in the 1950s, he created InterArm in Alexandria, Virginia, with one warehouse in England. But honestly, there was warehouses like all over the world of weapons, of guns.
I bet he knew a lot.
Knew a lot.
He's like, that's the gauge. That's the safety button.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pull that. That'll release the clip.
He actually did go around to Central American countries and was one of the first guys to demonstrate AR-10s.
Oh.
When it first came out. Yeah, so he did do that.
Cool.
He said, don't touch that.
So he was kind of like a Tony Stark kind of then.
He didn't make them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He dealt them, you know?
Okay.
But still, his company is to thank for the initial commercial availability of military firearms in the U.S. So instead of just buying sports guns, he made military-grade weapons available to the layman here in the U.S.
Oh, good job.
Yeah, you know. He also... InterArms, in general, was the top exporter of guns on the free market for a while. He was the largest private dealer for both sides of the Central American guerrilla wars. And he sold hundreds of guns to the dictator of Cuba, Fulgencio Bautista. But when he shipped those guns were interceded by Fidel Castro and his rebels. Instead of just staying out of it, Samuel wrote to Castro and told him that he needs to pay for the guns or give them back. And
how did he respond?
Fidel invited him to Cuba and bought some more.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So money talks. Wow. Money talks.
I would just love to read the letter just to see what's like, hey, how you doing? Hope you're... Holidays are going well. Notice that you took a shipment of guns. Maybe if you could give those back and pay for them?
No. Please, come to visit Cuba. We will smoke cigars and maybe I will buy some more. That's horrible, Fidel Castro. But it is him.
I gotta be honest. I don't think I've ever heard Fidel Castro talk. So it's either that voice or I feel like closer to like a Mickey Mouse of like,
yes.
So it's needless to say, Samuel amassed a fortune on guns throughout his life. The family.
That's what we should do. We should start selling guns to pay for this podcast, you know, just to like, take the money that we're making from the podcast, buy some guns, and then sell them.
Okay. The family lived mostly in between Monaco and the U.S. near, when they lived in the U.S., they lived in Alexandria, Virginia, where the company was started.
Okay.
In the 19, so then we fast forward. And in the 1980s, when Suzanne and Diana were adults, their father bought them Ashland Farms, a sprawling estate in the town of Warrenton, Virginia. On Ashland Farms, the property's main house is an 18th century manor built in 1725 with 8 bedrooms and 7 baths.
And 12 ghosts.
Yes.
Yeah. Just like so many ghosts.
Yeah.
And like not the fun ghosts.
No, these are not good ghosts. Real,
like Confederate army soldiers.
It's those ghosts. It sat on 300 acres of land, so more ghosts there. And it includes horse stables, tennis courts, a heated ground pool and jacuzzi, a 3-bedroom carriage house, which is the guest house, and a pond. You can go online right now and see the interior has, it's like, it's pretty, it's very pretty. It's a pretty house. The interior was renovated in 2016. And so now it's very bright and airy and pretty. But it is the absolute opposite of how Susan kept the house. So Susan lived in the-
Was she a hoarder?
She was not a hoarder. She was the opposite of a hoarder. She just didn't have anything in the house. She had 2 rooms that were like fully like furnished, and everything else was just empty or barely anything in there. And then she had like weird things. She had like tacky taste. You look at the pictures and it's like also like it's tacky, like maroon carpet and wall to wall.
Ugh.
And like she had a suit of armor in there that even the police were like, why does she have this?
I'm an iconoclast of style.
I gotta be honest, that really sounds great. I would love to have wall-to-wall maroon carpet and a full suit of armor.
She's like, I'll leave a plate and a fork in each room in case I want to eat in there that night.
That is genius.
It's pretty genius.
Thank you kindly.
She lived in the main house. And her sister, Diana, lived in the guest house. People all that saw inside the houses also said that Susan and Diana insisted on doing their own cleaning. And most of the hired help took care of the grounds outside of the house.
They don't want to be judged about the plate thing.
Also, like, yeah, I mean, look, if there's one thing I know that affluent white women, like, it's... doing their own cleaning.
Cleaning, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
They just love to tell you that how you're doing it wrong or show all the things you're doing wrong with it and just be like, Google it. Just Google how to clean a fork. And you're like, I can't, the fork is clean. I've washed it so many times.
Oh, hand it over. I'll just do it myself. By the way,
not that I'm arguing or anything or say that I know about this.
Not that you're talking about your ex-living situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, the extent of their weirdness was just rumors. And there's rumors about everyone in Warrenton, Virginia.
Yes, that is a Warrenton fact.
This tiny, technically only 4-mile stretch of land is the wealthiest town in the wealthy county of Fauquier. No, okay. That's not it.
No.
Okay, show me the word real quick.
I spent 10 minutes trying to pronounce this before we started, Lori. You
really did.
I looked up a YouTube video. I couldn't fucking Fauquier.
In the wealthy Fauquier County.
No. What is it?
Fauquier.
Okay. So every time it needs to be said, Cash is going to say it. Because I've spent 20 minutes at this point trying to figure it out. And I keep saying Fauquier, and that's not it. Okay. In the county, in the wealthy county of
Fauquier,
one of the highest income counties in the nation. According to Vicky Moon, author of The Middleburg Mystique, A Peek Inside the Gates of Middleburg, Virginia, the area code 20118 is one of the most coveted in the U.S., with a growing wait list at the post office just to get a mailbox with the right zip code.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah.
What is your zip code? 200.
20118.
20118? Oh, never mind. Said the cop. So stupid.
As of the publishing of her book, there's even a guy in town, he's probably still there, who has the vanity plate 20118.
Ugh.
Yeah. It's that kind of town.
But, I mean, can we just, for a second, I'd just like to acknowledge how dumb the name is. Fakir County? Fakir. Come on.
Fakir. I think it's like because we're butchering it because we're American and it's French.
Fakir?
I just think it's like, Fakir. It's funny to me that the zip code for the, it's like this is the most sought after county and it's like, you know, it's Fakir County. It's fucking here. That's what I think of. So, yeah, I just think that's so. I can't even.
It's like giving me an anxiety attack to keep trying to pronounce it. So I'm going to stop because it makes me feel like a stupid American slob that I can't say it.
You'll have to forgive her. This is her first time in Fakir County.
Fakir.
No, not Fakir.
You're saying Fakir. It right.
No, I think it doesn't sound right. It doesn't, and it's not right.
It's
See?
Yeah, I mean, of course I doubt myself.
Anyway, let's move on. Some fun facts about Warrington and Fakir. Say it.
Fakir
County. Robert Duvall grew up here.
Oh, yeah. He's a hell of an actor.
Really?
Yeah.
I love Robert Duvall.
Yeah. He still keeps a property there. And it was a big scandal when his wife left him because she left him for a guy in town named Jeff Gable, who was the main pool builder in town. So now they call him the pool boy all over town.
As a sign of disrespect.
Wow. I mean, pretty much.
Calling somebody anything boy is really...
Because he was the main pool guy in town. Like, he built pools.
Sure, he built pools.
But then, like, when the rumor spread, it came to Hollywood and it was like the pool... She left him for the pool boy.
That's such a... Yeah, what a tawdry affair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that happened there. And then Linda Tripp moved there.
Ugh.
After the Lewinsky scandal because she wanted like peace and quiet.
She started her own like gossip rag.
Yeah. With Vicky Moon. Vicky Moon's whole book is about gossip. It's just, it's great. But it's basically her being like, I live across the post office. And everything happens at the post office. And I was like, I don't think everything in town... happens at the post office. You're just saying that because that's where you live.
Yeah.
I think everything that happens in the area that she wants it to happen happens at the post office. I think if you went to the grocery store, you could be like, everything happens at the grocery store. So, everything happens everywhere.
Yeah.
That's where people are.
Yeah.
But before Linda Tripp and, you know, scandal with Robert Duvall. Well, actually, after that, Susan and Diana were living here, right? And Susan and Diana were already very embedded into Virginia culture. They had more money than most people in the area. People said that Diana was more outgoing than Susan, but they were both very reclusive. Basically, I feel like they went to like the bare minimum of social events that they felt they had to go to for that society, to function in that society.
Did they host any parties?
No. No, but they might have been one of the town is huge on hunting and like, well, we're about to talk about it, but they're huge on anything to do with like horses. So the house that they live in is one of the original points for one of these like point to point races, which I think is just, I'm sorry, I don't know what it is. I think it's like fox hunting plus racing. I don't know.
Huh. Interesting.
So the property it lived on, or the property they lived on, like the grounds used to be part of that. And that's still a thing that they do every year.
Weird.
That's just, you know, weird. I mean, I'm white and I don't get it.
So I don't, yeah, I don't understand.
It's not even that. It's just wealth. It's wealth.
It's money. Yeah. It's crazy.
How you spend your time when you have everything you need is just like, well, I guess we should start killing things.
That's this place. That's this place because, like, they don't have anything but time and money here, and they live in the country. So they do all this weird stuff. And most of the, like, founding people of the town were Confederates, like rich guys from the Confederacy.
Yeah.
So it's a little problematic. It's like a lot of old Confederate money. And, you know, they love their polo and they love their horses. And that's it.
The South Arrasa Gang.
So the women lived there for years, and it wasn't until Susan was 35 that things began to change for her, and she started coming out of her shell. She started developing a big interest in polo. And polo is apparently, like I was saying, huge in Warrenton. The people in the documentaries were so excited. For the when polo came up, like, they had a couple of, like, people who lived in the town or, like, were polo people, and they were just like, I mean, if you don't do polo in Warrenton, then you're nobody. Like, so you might as well fucking kill yourself.
It's like, oh, that's hilarious. Oh, man.
Polo is where it's at in Fauquier County. You know, the roar of the horse, the crack of the mallet on the ball, the quack of the duck. The skitter of the fox. I don't know how polo is played, but it is a staple here in Fauquier County. That's for sure.
The way I see Fauquier County is that everybody there is a horse girl. Everybody there just fucking will kill for horses.
Mm.
Yeah.
I carry on a pocket of sugar cubes.
Yeah, I remember one time there was a girl who lived in my cul-de-sac who she was into polo, and she was like, hey, do you want to come see a match? And I was like, what is it? And she was like, oh, we just run on horses, and it's like croquet, but we run on horses and hit a ball and around. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds so boring. I don't know why I would want to come watch you do that. Then we didn't talk after that. So,
I was going to say.
She was like, you're the wrong kind of white.
Yeah.
Not white enough, I see.
Mm.
But yeah, she just was like, she was super into polo. So she was probably like Diane or Susan. She was like, just, all she did was talk about polo. And, you know, when anybody buys a horse, it's like when they buy a nice car.
Yeah.
They tell you things that you're like, yeah, I picked that up just from being a person in the earth. I didn't need to buy a horse to know this. They're like, you know, buying a horse is a lot of work. Like, oh, really? I didn't know. Like,
you have to brush your hair every day, and they eat so much.
Yeah, yeah. No shit. Like, it's a horse. It's a living thing. Did you know that horses sleep? Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I'm
going to go. Susan already loved caring for horses. She was already, like, she had already done it her whole life. So, but she had always been on the side of literally just caring for horses. And now she was taking these classes. All of a sudden, she signed up for these classes.
I would love it if it was, like, a kid's polo class, and it was just all like 10-year-olds and then a 35-year-old woman on a full grown.
Lisa Pulitzer, who wrote a book about the case. That's her name, Lisa Pulitzer. She's the one that said that Suzanne found an ad in the paper and then just like signed up. And then signed up for 10 lessons.
That's the kind of research that will win Lisa Pulitzer.
She's also the one that the only one a Pulitzer. She's also
I was gonna say
a Webby.
A Webby.
Incidentally, Pulitzer, she pronounces the names of the other people super, super fucking, like, pretentiously.
She pronounces it Suzanne. But Sarah also said that that's the way it was pronounced, like that. So I'm assuming that's the way it was pronounced in town.
Oh, okay.
And everybody else in law enforcement and stuff is like, it's Susan. We're going to call her Susan because she's Susan. To be fair, it is because it's spelled S-U-S-A-N.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
It's Susan. Do they say Diane when they say her name?
No, they just say Diana.
All right. Well, there we go. Hypocrites.
She's still a hypocrite.
So soon after signing up for lessons, she set her sights on one of her instructors, an Argentinian polo player, Tomas Maldonado. Numerous polo players in the area were Argentinian. And the way that one of the Time magazine articles structured it was truthful, but it was like, it's just so offensive where it's like, basically, there's like, these are things you know about the wealthy, you know, like, you know that they have like big houses and, you know, bonds and hidden money. But one of the few things you don't know is that it's like basically like the stock of Argentinian males that come to town all the time for polo.
Weird. Oh, Jesus. That sounds so creepy. Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Stock of, ugh.
Yeah. I'm being a little bit more crass than he put it, but that's basically what it is. And that's probably is what it is, you know, in essence. But this was, so this was a normal thing where there's like a bunch of like Argentinian polo players that come in and they're normally sponsored by one of the wealthy landowners, honestly, in the area. And like, so they give them room and board and they give them a salary to be on their polo team. And so they could also do other things, you know, on the side, like freelance for other teams or teach.
Mm.
To make like extra money and stuff.
Yeah, to make extra money. So Susan starts getting interested in Tomas, but Tomas has zero interest in Susan. He's like a star athlete. He has a girlfriend. He probably has multiple girlfriends. And he's not like interested at all in her face.
Yeah, I mean, she's her like face. 15 years too old.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I just love that he just, that would be the best thing. Oh, Cash, could you do Tomas letting Suzanne know that he's just not interested in her face?
Suzanne, we are spending a lovely time together, but I wanted to let you know that your face is, how do you say?
No, don't say.
Made for radio?
Oh.
Perdona me. I have to go play polo.
Yeah. I don't know why that makes me, I want him to be the one to give all the, just the shitty news to people.
Yeah. Well, this didn't really stop Suzanne from caring, and she followed Tomas around, and she started staying late at the barn. Like, do you need help with the horses?
No, we are fine.
I could stroke this one for you.
Why don't you stroke the exit door?
And then
just not understanding the words, but then also just pure hate for this woman. That's what I love.
She also started following him into town and stalking him at bars, in different clubs, when he was going out on dates with his girlfriend. And then in 1995, he still had, also this is like a case of harassment that was totally glossed over by everybody, because it's like, if a guy did this to a woman, then it would be considered harassment. But they don't even bring this up ever again. And,
oh, wow.
And he just also has to, like, deal with teaching her still. Because he's still teaching her this whole time.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And he's not going to, like, speak out against her.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that she, like, throughout the teaching is trying to hold his hand. Anyway, every chance she gets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold the reins tight like this. She puts his hand on her hand, on his hand, like this. He's like, nah.
No. So then in 1995, at a professional polo match, Tomas introduced Susan and probably a few of his other students to one of the players that day, Roberto Villegas. Roberto was the team's star player. He was the highest rated at his club at the time. Roberto was a big guy. He was a cool guy. He was like a big personality, and he loved to hang out, and he loved to party, and he loved to flirt, and he was confident, and he was, you know, like, everybody loved him. Everybody loved Roberto.
Hey, it's me, Roberto. ¿Qué te pasa?
Hey, Roberto.
Hey, what's up, Chichi? Hey, what's up, Rich?
But on the flip side, Roberto was also known for his temper. He was said to threaten violence at the drop of a hat. And it was probably his Argentinian pasión.
What the fuck, man? I cut you!
Okay. Sounds a little New York for me, but...
There was Latin in there. No, okay. It wasn't from Argentina.
I always love when they say, like, he's got the Latin blood in him. It's like, he's got an anger problem.
Yeah. Has nothing to do with it. It's just fucking... He's gotta go to therapy. Yeah, we all do.
Unresolved issues. That's not Latin blood.
One of the funniest things I heard in Law & Order, I'm on the third season of the original one right now. Somebody got killed, and one of the cops was like, well, he was probably either Latino or Italian. They're the only ones who kill for love. And I was like, dude,
they're the only ones.
But I was like, kind of like, it's a really fun way to say that stereotype. It's horrible.
Yeah. Like, wow. Well, was this officer white? Because I gotta tell you, white people are really great at coming up with random stereotypes.
Yeah.
That you're like, I don't even know what that means.
So upon being introduced, Susan and Roberto were immediately attracted to each other. Her crush for Tomas disappeared. Phew.
Thank God.
What do you want to bet he was like, I have to introduce her to Roberto.
That's
I think that's
how I'll save myself.
Absolutely.
I think that was part of it. But then once Tomas started noticing that things were getting serious between the two, he tried to warn Roberto about her previous behavior. But it was too late.
That's kind of nice of him, though, to say that, to be like, hey, man, just so you know, she's a little loco.
She would hold you like a horse. Like a horse, puto.
What if I want to be held like a horse? I'm hung like a horse.
You don't understand.
So now you're just keeping it on your phone.
I was excited. I didn't know I said something stupid. Keep going. let's not live in my mistake.
I was trying to figure out if you were doing a meta thing where you yourself was doing it, playing that, or if you were Roberto playing that in the scene.
Okay. It was Roberto playing that in the scene.
All right.
We're keeping that in.
Good.
So the two started a relationship, but nobody around them really took the relationship seriously at first. Because Roberto almost couldn't help himself, and he flirted with women all the time. They went out to social events together, and he would be talking to other girls. And it seemed more of like a competition thing, really, because like they would also play in matches together, which is kind of fun, but it seems like a territorial thing for them somehow.
Wait, Roberto would play in matches with...
Yeah. Yeah, because she was a polo player now, because she had been taking lessons for a while.
Okay.
She wasn't great. They make that clear.
Did you guys ever watch Malcolm in the Middle?
Yeah.
There was a really great episode where Jane, I forgot her name, but the mother takes dancing lessons, takes salsa lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the episode, you think you see it from her perspective and you think that she's doing really well and that she just sort of takes it naturally. And that you find out that she's like, oh, I have a hidden talent. I'm actually a really great dancer. And the instructor comes up to her and goes, I want to take you on as my pupil. And they start dancing. And then he goes, I just, there's nothing more I can teach you. You have to go to a special class. And she's like, oh, great. And then come to find out that she's actually terrible at dancing. And she keeps accidentally kicking and hitting people because she just is like really wide with her arms. And the guy is just basically sending her to like the little kids class because he's just like, I can't help you. And you're a danger to everybody. So I just imagine that's what's happening here is that she thinks she's really great, but really she's just like wildly throwing a stick around.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. They send her to the other instructors, which are just like ponies.
Yeah, the little kids exactly. With their ponies. It's just a bunch of toddlers and some ponies. She's like, I'm gonna fucking crush this.
But then as the summer wrapped up and Roberto was expected to continue following the polo circuit, which was headed down to Florida, he announced that his plans had changed and he was staying behind with Susan. He was gonna work at a nearby farm and tend to Susan's farm for free.
What?
Yeah. Weird. Roberto had come from humble beginnings, so he wasn't a stranger to hard work, but the decision to go from star polo player to a farmhand seems extreme.
He wanted to be a kept man.
Yep, that is the big theory. Mm-hmm. That Roberto and Susan likely talked about marriage, and Roberto considered the quality of life that would mean for him. After all, being a professional polo player is expensive, and you can't do it alone. And without a patron for the season, Roberto would need to pay for the maintenance, care, and transportation of his horses and equipment alone.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. I was going to say that she activated his prostate, but I think the money thing is probably the closer thing. It's become my answer for everything, really. That's... I got a check email back to me from my credential for my teacher's credential, which I sent two checks and I had to stop payment on one and they sent back one. And my aunt said, why do you think that they tried to cash this check? And I was like, maybe it activated his prostate. I don't know. I don't know why they're, she's like, Laurie, I am your aunt.
That's good.
So Roberto tended to Ashland Farms and worked at another farm. And he did this for like a while. And then in 97, so about a year and a half later, Susan and Roberto started their own polo team with Roberto as the star player. It wasn't the worst deal, but it wasn't a great deal for Roberto because the deal included room and board for him at her place. And, you know, care for the horses and the new horse team, but no salary for Roberto. And if he had had a regular sponsor, he would also have a salary on top of, you know, room and board and all that stuff. This essentially meant that Suzanne had Roberto completely under her financial control. Then they put their team together and they started raising the ponies and they immediately started arguing about how hard he was on the horses when training them for polo. It was like a huge argument about it. It wasn't like you're being too mean to the dog.
He's like, you got to beat them into submission.
Yeah, basically. And she's like, no.
Probably.
Total submission. Total submission. Total submission. He's just repeating that at her.
I did a sketch one time where it was like the point of the sketch was that I was supposed to yell at a dog. And everyone thought it would be funnier if we got a real dog. So this girl brought in her parents' dog. And I kept saying, I don't think it's going to be that funny, guys. and we would rehearse it. And they didn't want me to yell at the dog because they were like, we don't want it to hurt its feelings. So then it got to the point where I literally had to like walk up the steps of IO and yell down and to the appearance of the dog. Just like, all right. Yeah, no, this is hilarious, guys. This is great. I love the sketch. It's just because they didn't want to hurt this stupid dog's feelings. Even though every single time I saw the dog, I'd whisper, nobody loves you. So
wait, did you yell at the dog from the top of the stairs and the dog was on the stage? Because that's funny. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, the dog was on the stage. So, but then people were like not really laughing because it was like just a regular dog. And then it was, you know, and then I was yelling at the dog. I forgot the reason for the sketch. I think it was just like Lori yells at a dog for 30 seconds. I mean, honestly, it was a really stupid idea, but it was like, we were like, let's get a regular. So we had like screaming arguments about using this stupid dog because they were like, you got to be gentle with it. And I was like, I literally am telling it that it's a stupid dog and that I hate it. And I'm like, how can I be gentle if that's what I'm saying to this dog? So it was, yeah. So I get it. I get what Roberto's going through.
Yeah. It seems that way. Seems like you have a really, yeah. Really familiar.
Yeah, you understand.
Yeah, really familiar training with dogs and
basically
horses.
The same thing. The
same thing. Okay. So on top of that, rumors quickly spread that he was hanging out at bars again and flirting with other women. And he started, and this was totally plausible because he started taking, he started freelancing for other polo teams on the weekends to make money because he was like, holy shit, I'm not making any of my own money.
Ugh.
So they started going out to the bars and he started flirting with women that got back to her. And she got really pissed. And they would always be arguing, basically.
Because they were still in a relationship, right?
Yeah. Okay. Their relationship was de-evolving, basically. Into just like everybody's seeing them fight all the time and argue. Then in late August 1997, Susan showed up to the police station. She sat down to report that Roberto had made direct and specific threats to kill her. She reported that he said that he was going to choke her and shoot her in the head. When the police told her that she should file a restraining order, she refused. She filed the report, made a follow-up appointment for a month later, and then left.
Sounds pretty scheduled.
Yeah.
Wait, you can make appointments at a police station?
I'm pretty sure like you can't if you live where we live, but if you live in Warrenton, Virginia, and so you're a white lady that comes in and it's like, I'd like to make an appointment a month from now, they'd be like, sure.
Everything is all about appointments here in Warrenton. Mm-hmm. I made an appointment at the Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
Table for three.
Table for three around 7 p.m.
Shortly thereafter, Suzanne left for Monaco to see her ailing father, and Roberto stayed behind.
In Fauquier County.
Mm-hmm. He took full advantage of the break and partied in town as much as possible. Until she came back. When she returned, the arguments continued. Then in September, the couple and their team headed out of town for a polo match in Pittsburgh. There was this weird incident that happened at the hotel when they got there because I guess it's one of the customs is that if you manage a polo player, you can't stay in the same room as them. Even if they're in a relationship. So she had reserved two rooms and they only had one room for her. And so she freaked out. And then I think she started arguing. I think the reason that people emphasize this is because she must have started arguing with him after this argument.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So they start arguing and the argument can, they have the match, they have the polo match, and then the argument continues after the match. And Roberto is pissed because he has another polo match the next day that he wants to do in Potomac, which is USA versus Argentina.
Oh, big one.
The big one for him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, no, you're not doing it because the horses are too tired. So he's like, I don't care. We will play. And
I don't care.
What puta horses will play?
Pinche horses.
Yeah, he probably like started getting like angry about the horses. Like, the horses are stupid horses. They're stupid.
So they both put their foot down. It's happening. It's not happening. And that's it. That's where they leave the argument. And then they just like walk away from each other. They sleep in separate rooms that night because of the match already. And because they're just pissed at each other too. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning at 7:45 a.m. on September 7th, Roberto shows up to Ashland Farms to take the horses. And Susan is already there. Then later that morning, Susan calls 911 and says there's a shot and dead man in her house. And she identifies him as Roberto Villegas.
No! And then she made an appointment first. So she made an appointment and then she called and said, I'm calling about my appointment. There's a dead man in my house.
That's the funny thing about 911 in Warrington. You have to call and then you have to make an appointment on the first call and then they call you back and then you give them the emergency.
Yeah. It's like, hi, I'd like to make an appointment for 30 seconds from now. Okay. There's a man inside my house.
Save that for the appointment, ma'am. Save that for the appointment.
Sorry.
Thank you.
When police arrived at the scene, they find Suzanne and her sister waiting at the door. Suzanne is stoic, almost dazed, and her arm is covered in long, thin scratches. She doesn't move out of the way immediately at first. Like, she does that thing where, like if she were, like, the final girl at the end of, like, a horror movie where she's just, like, the police arrive and they're like, ma'am, are you okay? Are you okay? And she's just like, I'm fine. Like that. But she's, like, just weird.
Yeah, that's how she is 24/7.
Yeah,
everything is good.
Yeah. So then the police ask her to lead them to the body, and she leads them into the kitchen. And in the kitchen, they find the body of Roberto halfway under the kitchen table, face down, and having been shot 4 times.
Oof.
He had passed by the time that they arrived, and there was blood pooling underneath him. The rest of the kitchen was completely undisturbed. While at the scene, Suzanne said that Roberto had threatened her with a knife, and at some point, she got a hold of the gun and shot him. That was it. That was like her story.
Really? That's it?
That's it. When she, she was questioned at the scene and she's like, he had a knife and then at some point I got the gun and I was scared for my life. I shot him.
That's a Warrington mystery.
So the police immediately noticed a huge number of things that were inconsistent with her story or half story. First, the blood splatter showed that he was seated when he was shot.
Ugh.
Nothing on the table, not even the plate that held crumbs in front of him, had been disturbed.
Really? Ooh, geez, that's not good for her.
Yeah. In Roberto's mouth, there was a piece of half-eaten croissant.
Poisson?
Which he means he was eating when he was shot.
That sucks. What a horrible time to get shot.
Yeah. If he had been threatening somebody, especially physically, he'd be standing. He would not be eating. He'd be holding a knife or something.
Yeah, and he would for sure not be eating a croissant because there's no way you can seem intimidating while eating a croissant. That's just not possible.
I'm imagining somebody
eating a
croissant sitting, being like,
"You have to be
kill you,
Tony Soprano."
Yeah,
that's the only person who could do it.
Yeah,
yeah.
The knife at the scene seemed to have been placed in the crook of his arm with no blood on it. And, with no blood on it. So if he had been holding it, it would be underneath him and it would be covered in blood if he had been shot. So it was literally placed on his arm. I shouldn't laugh.
It was like a handkerchief underneath it, and like a note that says the weapon we're going to stage or something like that.
Yeah.
It's almost like they went next to his body laying on the floor and then took a marker and drew like a word bubble. I tried to kill her.
Terrible. There was some blood on the very, very tippy tip of the knife, which could probably explain the long, thin cat scratches that she had.
Oh, so she did those to herself.
No. Have you ever seen an Argentinian guy kill? And I'm sure you all have. You see them.
You see them just do little cat scratches.
Yeah, that's how you start. Coming to kill you. Now.
Love scratches. That's what they're called.
Yes.
Or death scratches. There we go. That's more like it.
Argentina.
Actually, they do love scratches and death scratches, which is oddly the same thing. So.
As for the gun she used, Suzanne explains that she keeps a gun in every room of the house for safety.
Along with the plate and fork.
You just never know.
Exactly.
You never know when you're going to need to eat or when you're going to need to shoot somebody.
I don't want somebody to come in here and watch me eat, for God's sakes.
She was weird, so maybe that was the thing. She had used a Walter, which was a brand of gun that helped make her father so, so very rich.
Oh, the Walther P something? Yeah.
Yeah. In the bedroom.
That's about it.
In the bedroom, detectives found the holster for the knife she claimed Roberto used against her. Susan stuck to her story and saying that she said that she shot him in self-defense. They arrested her and then took her to the station, where she immediately lawyered up with defense attorney Blair Howard, who was the star defense attorney in the Commonwealth versus Lorena Bobbitt.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Her trial was about to be underway when her father died at the age of 71 in Monaco after a series of strokes. I kept laughing when I wrote series of strokes.
Why?
Because it's penis.
How'd you not get that, Cash? Come on.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
At trial, when she testified, Suzanne said that when he came over that morning, they argued again in the kitchen about Roberto leaving with the horses. That then he grabbed a knife and he grabbed her and he threatened her and he made the cuts on her arm. But she reasoned with him and he calmed down and he sat down. And then she offered to make him a cup of coffee. As he turned around, like while he was sitting, and she went over to the drawer, she got at her gun. That's when he turned and came at her again, and then she shot at him. The prosecution.
That's weird.
It's a stupid story. The prosecution was sure that it was an open and shut case for first degree murder because of all the forensic evidence and the fact that it looked like she had premeditated the murder all the way back in the summer when she went to the police station and filed a report about Roberto. The defense brought her sister to the stand. Diana testified that she came into the main house 10 minutes after she heard the shots. In an effort to negate the idea from the prosecution that Susan had doctored the crime scene.
Well, 10 minutes after, she could have done all that stuff in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I also think that her weird sister probably helped her. She was probably the one that, like, she's like, oh, God, Susan, what have you done? Mm-hmm. We've got to fix this. And she, like, grabbed, she's probably the one that grabbed the knife. It's like, here, we'll put it here.
Let me scratch your arm for a minute or two.
Yeah.
We should also put the salt next to him because men put salt on their food. Ridiculous.
They also brought in Roberto's ex-girlfriends to testify against his temper. In the end, Susan's money won in the Virginia court system. Instead of first-degree murder, Susan was convicted on May 13, 1998, of voluntary manslaughter and sentenced to 60 days in county jail.
And what else?
And a $2,500 fine.
Ugh. And what else?
Right? What else does she get, Charlie?
And nothing. Think you're playing scot-free.
She served 51 days
Ugh.
In special accommodations. Mm-hmm. They emptied out the local jail for her. She had her own phone. She had her own food.
What?
She was allowed multiple visitors all day. The sheriff cited concerns for her safety because of the six other inmates that were in there before her. That's why they moved them out, because they were all serving longer sentences for lesser charges. And they thought that maybe they'd be mad at her. One of the women, Kimberly Anderson, who was moved out of there, put it best when she said, "Yeah, some people were real mad when they heard about her sentence, but no one would have done anything. She's the one serving time for killing someone, not any of us." Kimberly had, at the time, 11 weeks left on an 11-month sentence for forgery and credit card theft. So she got 11 months for credit card theft. And she got 60 days for murder.
Murder.
Cold-blooded murder.
Wow.
What a joke.
That's crazy.
Yeah, the prosecution basically took the deal because basically it meant that they didn't, the jury wouldn't believe, nobody believed that it was self-defense, but it was voluntary manslaughter, which is so insulting because that means it was, that normally means it was an accidental death. Like you hit somebody with your car.
I like it. You said her money won.
Yeah, her money won. The community mourned Roberto because everybody knew that Suzanne had outright killed him. So they do hold an annual polo match in his name, which is nice. Roberto was survived by his son, Justin, his mother, and his sister. But the injustice of his death doesn't stop there. Margaret Bonnell, Roberto's ex and the mother of his son, Justin, sued Roberto's mother and sister for the right to have Justin, the little boy, be the sole beneficiary of Roberto's estate. She finally won that, and then after she won that, she then sued Suzanne, on behalf of the kid, for a wrongful death suit of $15.3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Suzanne offered an initial amount of $140,000.
Wow.
In 2003, Suzanne's lawyers settled out of court with an undisclosed sum that seemed to, according to the Washington Post, leave Suzanne very happy leaving the courtroom and Justin's mother pretty fucking pissed.
Jesus.
Blair Howard, who was still her attorney, decided to be messy, and he told the Washington Post that if they had tried to move forward with the suit, then they would point out how Roberto had moved shortly after the child's birth and was not really present in his life, insinuating that they had no right to any claims about Roberto's life. A local attorney also commented that he said that the Bonnells could easily be painted as fortune seekers. In 2004, Suzanne and Diana sold Ashland Farms and moved into a larger 450-acre estate dubbed LeBaron Farm in Culpeper County, Virginia. The house is an award-winning home, and its design firm, Versace Newman Partners, won a recognition award for it in 2006. They are alive and well.
That is bullshit.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Wow. Murderers. Well, murderer.
Murderer.
But also accomplice, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably a murderer and accomplice.
I mean, who knows?
Well, they're sisters. They're weird reclusive sisters. They're weird rich sisters who were like weird before the murder, and now they're like, now they're just fucked.
I mean, they're probably the same because they were so weird. They didn't let the murder affect how they are. God, that's so upsetting, dude. That sucks so much.
Yeah, man. That poor guy. I mean, look, he made, like, maybe he didn't make the best choices, but he shouldn't have lost his life, for sure.
Not at all.
No. Not at all. It was all supposed to be cool, man. It's supposed to be cool. You're going to get married, settle down, get your own polo company.
Yeah.
You can't polo forever, you know. So you're trying to ease on down. And then like, she's fucking crazy, man.
There's the polo slogan. Yeah. Can't polo forever, man. They have it on signs at their stadiums.
Yeah. All right, everybody.
I was just gonna say that should be a t-shirt. You can't polo forever, man.
It's true.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have an idea for a case, email us at thebloodypodcast@gmail.com. We promise to read it and we will add it to our list. And if you get lucky, we'll do it.
Boom.
And we're gonna try to do everything you guys request. Why not?
Damn right.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night.
Bye.